to Burnout and Breakthroughs, the podcast where nonprofit professionals and purpose-driven people refuse to glorify exhaustion. I'm Samantha, nonprofit leader, a burnout survivor, and somebody who has absolutely been blindsided more than once in this work. If you caught last week's episode, we peeled back the curtain on the myth of the selfless servant, what it looks like, how it sneaks up on us, and how to incorporate boundary setting in the workplace. But first, I'd like to invite you to take a deep breath with me here. Inhale and exhale. Before we get into today's conversation, I want to remind you of something that I wish somebody had told me years ago. You can't pour from an empty jug. So much of nonprofit culture teaches us to keep pouring anyway, to keep showing up empty, and to keep saying yes when we really should be saying no. We end up letting ourselves be the go-to person until eventually that person comes back to bite us. Nobody puts that stuff into the job description. Today's episode is called No One Told Me This because I want to discuss the quieter aspects, all of the unspoken truths and the warnings that nobody gave us before we jumped in headfirst into nonprofit work. The topics we will discuss are the things that you only learn about after being in the trenches for a while, and I want to bring a voice to these silent truths because they are costing people their health, their stability, and sometimes even their calling. I still remember one of the first pieces of advice that I got when I first entered this field. Someone once told me that if I followed my passion, I would never work a day in my life. Sounds super idealistic, but no one ever followed up with that phrase that somebody could exploit that passion. Research in the Harvard Business Review describes burnout not as a lack of a resilience, but as a mismatch between people's passion and the conditions of their workplace. So it's not that we're weak, it's our systems just know how to milk us dry. And recently, there has been science that backs up our feelings. Duke University researchers found that when managers see people as passionate about their work, they think that it is more acceptable to treat them poorly. And this includes asking them to work extra hours without any additional pay. They call this passion exploitation, and it is exactly how it sounds. According to their 2020 article in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, they show that people do in fact deem poor worker treatment, such as asking employees to do demeaning tasks that are irrelevant to their job description, or asking employees to work extra hours without pay, as more legitimate when workers are presumed to be quote-unquote passionate about their work. They identified two areas that legitimize this process and thought. One of them being that there are assumptions that are made of passionate workers that they would have just volunteered for this job if they were given the chance. And two, that the belief that for passionate workers, the work in it of itself is its own reward. They also specifically found that these assumptions and behaviors are most pronounced for people who believe in a just world. If you're thinking, wait, that really sounds like my last job, or that sounds really familiar, you're not wrong. In the nonprofit sector, we've built an entire industry on these exact assumptions. Our passion for the mission becomes permission for exploitation. When you're told you're not here for the money, or you're asked to stay late because the community is counting on us, that is passion exploitation in action. This research proves what we've all been feeling, that our dedication is becoming weaponized against us. And this is a systemic problem that we need to bring a voice to and make it heard. So let's investigate the illusion versus the reality. Let's dive into some of the top three myths. Myth number one is that passion is enough. We often hear this. If you love the mission, everything else is just going to fall into place. What actually happens is that passion gets used as leverage. Your boss will ask you to work late, take on projects outside of your capacity, or they'll ask you to stretch resources further. when you hesitate, they might say something like, but don't you care about the cause, or the community needs you to do this, or I need you to do this because of dot, dot, dot. Stanford's Catherine Baird wrote in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, talks about leadership treats our passion as an endless renewable resource. Remember from last week, I talked about the giving tree. Same type of situation here. If the organization wants more branches, more fruit, and more shade, the workers, we just continue to give and give and give until, again, the field is going to look like a clear-cut piece of land with nothing but stumps where there used to be thriving trees, thriving employees. And we know that taking on these continuous asks for energy depletes us so much that it takes years for any of us to recover from it. Similar to how a forest that has been clear cut will take decades before it ever starts to see any kind of renewal and regrowth. Myth number two is that impact equals metrics. When I first started, I thought impact meant helping communities. I remember this moment early on in my career where I had spent weeks working with a very large group of volunteer students who would go into local low-income area schools and help the students in the classroom with their English and math. And they would be there to tutor the students one-on-one. They'd also be their mentors. And many of these students came from very broken childhoods and traumatic backgrounds. And my volunteers were doing real messy human work. But when it came time for our quarterly report, it felt like none of that mattered. What mattered was whether we'd hit higher student testing scores and how many volunteer student hours I'd logged into the database. I sat there staring at these spreadsheet cells that were supposed to tell a story, capture hundreds of student transformations, and I realized pretty quickly that something just wasn't right. The numbers told the story, sure, but it wasn't the story of what actually happened. It was a story designed for someone who was never going to meet the students. They would never sit in the classroom and see relief in their eyes when they finally felt heard and seen. And they would never be the person that would see the light in these students' eyes when that math problem that they'd been struggling on for weeks finally clicked and they understood. Over time, I realized impact often gets reduced to numbers and outputs that please funders rather than the outcomes that change the lives. Professor Alnor Abraham, in his book, Measuring Social Change, says that nonprofits live in a paradox. Leaders ask nonprofit workers to solve complex, messy problems like poverty, inequity, and climate change, but they hold them accountable using these tidy, oversimplified metrics. This disconnect is really brutal. McKinsey found that most nonprofit groups track their performance by metrics such as dollars raised, membership growth, number of visitors, people served, and overhead costs. These metrics, sure, are important, but they don't measure the real success that an organization has in achieving its mission. The problem is that we are measuring activity and not the transformation. If you think about it, how do you measure hope restored? How do you quantify the moment when somebody realizes they're not alone? How do you put dignity preserved in a pie chart? You can't, but you can count workshops delivered, surveys completed, and how many people were served. So that's what we do. The thing that really gets under my skin is that experts have been calling this out for years, and one researcher actually put it, if you measure inputs and outputs, you're only measuring how much of the problem you're managing, not how much value you've created. But here we are, still playing the same game, pretending that saying served 500 clients tells us anything meaningful about whether those 500 people are actually better off. I've watched brilliant program staff get demoralized because their work that transforms communities doesn't translate neatly into the metrics that keep the lights on. I've seen people leave the sector not because they stopped believing in the mission, but because they couldn't reconcile the gap between what they were actually accomplishing and what they were being asked to prove. The National Council of Nonprofits acknowledges the shift that is happening. More nonprofits, grant makers, and government partners are focusing on outcomes rather than outputs. But let's be honest about what that actually looks like on the ground. It often means more complex reporting, longer evaluation processes, and even more time spent on documentation instead of the actual work. We all know that the numbers don't tell the whole story. The funders realize it, the board knows it, we know it, but we keep playing this game where everyone pretends that served 500 clients means the same thing as helped 500 people rebuild their lives. Sometimes the most impactful work that you are going to do isn't going to show up in any report. Sometimes preventing one person from giving up is worth more than a dozen successful program completions. But try explaining that to a grant committee that's going to be reviewing your renewal application for the next coming grant year. The tragedy in all of this is that measuring becomes the work instead of measuring the actual impact that we have on the clients and the communities. How many hours do we spend crafting reports instead of crafting solutions? How much energy is invested in documenting impact instead of creating it? We're so busy proving our worth that we lose time actually being worthy of it. When the numbers inevitably fall short of capturing the reality, guess who gets blamed? Not the broken measurement system. It's not the impossible expectations. We do. Your program gets cut. Your position gets restructured. Your passion gets questioned. Because if you were actually, quote unquote, making an impact, surely the data would show it. We all know that this is wrong, but good luck trying to explain that when budget season comes around. Myth number three is helping means self-sacrifice. This one runs deep. If you work in a nonprofit, you've probably heard you're not here for the money, you're here for the mission, which is true, but that line also normalizes underpaying staff, overextending them, and making them feel guilty for needing things like raises, healthcare, or time off. In last week's episode, you heard me talk about psychologist Christina Maslach, who talks about how burnout happens when there's a mismatch between what people value and what their workplace demands. In nonprofits, that mismatch is pretty much everywhere. You value service, but the system demands overwork. You value community, but the system isolates. You value fairness, but the paychecks just really do not reflect that. Here's what the numbers actually tell us. Nearly half of nonprofit leaders report struggling to recruit and retain staff because pay and workload are simply unsustainable. The National Council of Nonprofits recognizes that this is not just a staffing inconvenience, but a fundamental threat to the sector's ability to deliver on its mission. The cost shows up in burnout rates that should alarm really all of us. Nonprofit workers are 30% more likely to report burnout than their private sector peers. Not because they don't care, but because the system relies on their unpaid costs. When 95% of nonprofit leaders express concern about staff burnout, and a third say that it's a significant issue, we're talking about a sector-wide crisis. Imagine if 95% of those leaders who are expressing concern actually made an action on preventing burnout. Recently, researchers Sowaka and Fisk published a study on emotional labor in nonprofits. They found that the compassion and emotional care that we extend day after day is a risk itself and a factor for burnout. They call it the cost of compassion. If you've ever gone home completely drained, not from the work itself, but from carrying on so many emotions, this is what they're talking about. What has been your cost of compassion? What toll have you noticed in yourself over the last few years? These myths often are sold to us before we even take the job. You see a posting that says fast-paced environment, wear many hats, or a mission-driven culture, which all sounds great, but those are often code for underpaid, overextended, and chronically short-staffed. When our average turnover rate sits at 19%, which is comparative to the 12% across other sectors, something is broken. That's people who care deeply and who often go unseen in their struggle. Passion has become currency for organizational leaders. Instead of fair compensation, we get meaning. Why can't it be both? So in preparation for this episode, I started asking around. I started asking people in my network, my coworkers, online spaces that I'm a part of, and people in my community about what is something that they wish somebody had told them before they started working in nonprofits. And the floodgates opened. People had a lot to say. Some were hopeful and some were hard, but every bit of it felt real. One of my first conversations after posing this question, somebody came to me and said, "Make learning a priority." And I pondered this statement for a considerable amount of time. It might be easy to say, a little bit harder to do. Most of us get stuck in the daily grind of our own organization, and we don't typically have the capacity to learn beyond what we see daily. But they were right. When you step outside of your organization, you attend an industry event, join a session or a discussion, or even participate in a random online forum, use that as an opportunity to network and discover some fresh ideas. It's cool to see what others are doing in this space, and it can spark some good things that come out of it. Right now, with AI and the way that the landscape is rapidly evolving, if you are not in the rooms where these conversations are happening, you risk getting stuck in the old ways of doing things while other nonprofits are out there experimenting, testing, and figuring out new approaches. I've witnessed this in my own organization. Our IT department has completely blocked the use of any AI tools, while I'm seeing other nonprofits in my community starting to utilize it for some of the more mundane tasks that eat up a ton of valuable time that we don't have. Someone else in my network gave me the advice that kind of was a little bit of a gut punch. They said, "They'll be okay without you. When it's time to move on, do it." I know someone listening needs to hear that. Leaving never feels simple or easy, even when you know that you are burning out. The truth is that the work goes on, the mission continues, and sometimes the bravest thing that you can do is step away. They'll be okay. In many conversations, several people did mention relationships, not just with donors or partners, but with each other, inside and outside of your organization. And even across the sector. The nonprofit world is small, and you'll almost certainly cross paths with the same people repeatedly. Those connections can carry you, and honestly, they can save you. Developing community nonprofit forums once a month or quarterly to discuss what's happening with each other and within each organization and help identify areas where people are struggling or seeking advice is really beneficial. I've attended multiple versions of these over the years, and I still rely on those relationships and networks regularly when I need specific expertise. On the flip side, don't put all of your faith into boards. More than one person warned me about this. Boards can be wonderful, yes, but group dynamics aren't always logical or fair. One toxic board member can upend years of work. If you've been there, you know. Someone wrote in and said, "Pay attention from day one, how people treat you, how they respect your time. Are there any red flags on day one? If there are, don't ignore them." Just because someone works for a nonprofit doesn't make them a great boss or even a decent coworker. This is crucial advice because organizational culture reveals everything that you need to know about how quickly you could burn out. Pay attention to turnover rates at that specific organization and do a little bit of digging to find out why the turnover rate is higher than at other area nonprofits. Are employees leaving because their leaders haven't provided them with the necessary support to overcome the issues at hand? Are they grossly underpaid, even more than the typical nonprofit underpayment? A lot of us have learned this lesson the hard way. Listen to your gut. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. Something else that popped up in these conversations was structure or the lack of it. Let me paint you a picture of what this might look like. So many nonprofits have a flat structure, which is that titles don't mean much and systems that are there, but they're not really there. When I started at my first nonprofit role, I walked in thinking that titles meant everything or something. You know, you have director, you have manager, coordinator. It felt like there was a clear line of authority. That was my assumption, and I was wrong. The structure of my nonprofit was pretty flat. everyone weighed in on everything. For somebody who is as shy as I am, that was really disorienting. I didn't know whose opinion to listen to, and I didn't know who had the final say. The program director was asking me to change something, but then the development coordinator, who had been there longer, would tell me to do it differently. Meanwhile, the executive director was in back-to-back meetings and couldn't be reached for any kind of clarification. You'll get feedback from every direction, and half of it is going to contradict the other half. That marketing campaign that you spent 2 weeks on perfecting? Three different people are going to have three different opinions about whether it should go out or not. And somehow you are supposed to navigate those competing voices and still hit your deadline and make all of them happy. After a few weeks, I found myself just being extremely overwhelmed and isolated, and I felt really unsure of if I was doing a good job or messing up entirely. Nobody had prepared me for the reality that collaborative environment often means no clear decision-making process. You'll probably work long hours because when the system isn't in place, everything takes longer. Simple tasks become complex because there's no established process, there's no clear workflow, there might not be a single person who owns the final decision. You end up being in meetings about meetings, trying to figure out who's responsible for what. And this is what people mean when they talked about structure. Now, surprisingly, there are upsides to this chaos. In a lot of cases, there is comp time, there's flexibility, and there is room to try things that you wouldn't get to do in other sectors, for example. Because you wear different hats, you get to pick up different skills. When there's no rigid hierarchy, sometimes that means that you can propose an idea on Monday and implement it by Friday without any layers of approval needed. Of course, you are doing the work of three people because there are only five people total and somebody just quit. But sometimes that's how you discover what you actually enjoy. I never would have learned that grant writing or event planning or social media strategy was something that I was interested in and was really good at doing if I had stayed in my neat little communications coordinator box at a more traditional organization. So the question becomes, is the learning worth the confusion? Is the flexibility worth the lack of clear direction? For some people, absolutely. For others, the constant uncertainty becomes a source of chronic stress that no amount of comp time is going to balance out. The trick is figuring out early which type of person you are and whether the particular brand of beautiful chaos at your organization matches your tolerance for ambiguity. Because not all flat structures are going to be created equal, and some are collaborative and empowering, while others are just really disorganized and exhausting. Something else that I wasn't prepared for was the fact that belonging in a nonprofit often doesn't come automatically. So you know that feeling that you had back in school when you would walk into the cafeteria and you didn't know where to sit? Yeah, that can happen at work too, when you are surrounded by people who share your values. I think there is this assumption that because we're all here for the mission, we'll naturally click. That passion for the cause will translate into an instant workplace community. However, that's not how humans operate, and it is certainly not how organizations function. No one tells you that you have to build that belonging yourself when you first start working in a nonprofit. Research backs this up in a pretty stark way. Only about 20% of nonprofits have a formal employee engagement strategy. 80% of organizations in this sector are just hoping that belonging happens organically. The rest leave belonging up to chance, like some kind of workplace lottery where you either get lucky with great colleagues or you spend your days feeling like an outsider. When organizations leave belonging up to chance, people fall through the cracks. Perhaps you have walked into a new role at a nonprofit organization and wondered, where do I fit in here? The sad truth of it is that we have had those moments of feeling like an outsider. You know, I've been in team meetings where I didn't understand a joke that had been made because it was an inside joke. And I definitely have sat by myself at a lunch table watching other coworkers have conversations in their established circles. I was in a meeting recently with a fairly new employee, and I was checking in with them, asking how their first month in the organization and their role had been going. And they were honest with me, which I really appreciated. You know, they said that it felt like, yes, they were showing up every day to work, but they would go home still feeling invisible. And it wasn't because we were mean or the other coworkers were mean. They just didn't feel like they had the opportunity to become an active member in the culture that we had already developed on the team. Being included in the mandatory all-staff meeting that gets put on, you know, every quarter or every 6 months, it isn't the same as feeling valued by the team, even if that meeting is entirely devoted to team development. And I saw this in some other conversations that I was having with people. You know, some people were telling me about, you know, crying in their offices the first month, not because the work was hard, but because they just felt so disconnected from everyone around them. They didn't realize that they had to be the ones to make the first move to connect with their coworkers. In many workplaces, especially small nonprofits, everyone is so busy putting out fires that just reaching out to the new person kind of falls off the priority list. And it's not personal, but it does feel personal when you are the one sitting there wondering if anyone notices whether you're there or if you're going to show up that day for work. I think the hardest thing to learn in this situation is that sometimes belonging means that you find your people within the organization rather than trying to belong to the whole organization. Maybe it's the two other program staff who get your sense of humor, or the volunteer coordinator who has always had your back in meetings. It could also be the part-time bookkeeper who somehow becomes your closest ally. Building belonging isn't about being liked by everyone. It is about finding the connection that sustains you even when everything else feels chaotic. There also was some pretty poignant advice and things that people wish they had been told, including the crises that you think are going to break you right now, don't. For example, those budget deadlines or a panicked email or even a grant rejection. Later on, you're going to realize that those things weren't the things that defined you, your impact, or your career. Something else other folks have said was to not internalize the dysfunction. Every organization has some, nonprofit or otherwise, and some will have it worse than others. The key is learning to separate what is about the place and what is about you. Something to remember, and it took me a very long time to realize this, is that the role that you have, you are making a difference. It's not going to be every day. It's not going to be every moment. But the difference that you are doing is going to be enough. It's going to be enough for that person that you're helping. The community, the family, it's all going to matter and will have a lasting impact on the people that received your assistance. You know, no one told me that it was going to be a messy, beautiful, exhausting, chaotic role. And it's worth it if you know when to step in and when to step out. I was really early in my career. I was eager and very inexperienced. I was the go-to for everything. Communications, program design. I may have even unclogged the kitchen sink at one point in time. The always wanting to help mentality put me in situations that I shouldn't have been in. But I thought that if I were the jack of all trades or I was indispensable, that leadership would protect me and my job. That's what we've been told before, right? You know, do everything that you can do to make sure that you are seen as a strong employee so you are not the first person out the door when the layoffs happen. The truth is, being everyone's go-to eventually bites you in the ass. When you do everything, people suddenly stop recognizing anything as extraordinary. They just expect it. I kept internalizing this. When leadership said, "You're so strong, you'll figure it out," I didn't hear support. I heard, "Your struggle doesn't matter." The fact that we don't talk openly about these realities has consequences. When 42% of nonprofit employees consider leaving their jobs due to burnout, a lack of pay equity, or unsustainable workloads, we're facing an exodus. What happens when we don't discuss it? Well, retention plummets. Burnout has become one of the leading reasons nonprofit staff leave. Exhaustion from systems that consume rather than sustain is killing our workforce in the nonprofit sector. Trust erodes. When new hires walk in with rose-colored glasses and no one warns them, they often feel betrayed when reality sets in and they walk out 6 months later. People disappear quietly, not because they didn't care, but because no one gave them the truth early enough. How many brilliant, committed people have left this sector not because they lacked heart, but because the silence kept them unprepared? When 3/4 of our nonprofit leaders say that staff burnout is impacting their organization's effectiveness, and nearly half find it challenging to fill staff vacancies, we're not talking about individual struggles. We're talking about mission failure at scale. Stanford Social Innovation Review put it plainly. The nonprofit sector cannot afford to ignore the health and the sustainability of its workforce if it expects to deliver on its promises. We perpetrate silence, which brings me back to that clear-cut field metaphor. Imagine looking out and seeing nothing but stumps and all of the trees that once provided fruit and shelter and life is gone. That's what is happening when we don't protect the nonprofit workers. When silence is policy, people get cut down until there's nothing left. So if I could sit down with my younger self on the first day of my nonprofit career, I would have a couple of things that I would tell her. First one is to take a deep breath. This isn't a sprint. 2, you can't pour from an empty jug. Stop trying. 3, you can be passionate and still set boundaries. In fact, boundaries protect your passion. 4, rest is not betrayal. Rest is maintenance. Think of it as tending your garden. The more you water it, the more you provide rest, the more it'll flourish. 5, find something each week in your work that fills your soul, even just a little bit. If months pass without it happening, it might be time to ask whether you're in the right place. 6, check in with the mission every few months and let it ground you. But don't put the mission above your own health. The mission can't carry you when you are crumbling. 7, you don't owe your suffering to your cause. Your worth doesn't depend on an impact report, a donor's applause, or community expectations. 8, you can do everything right and things will still go wrong. Leadership can be toxic, systems can be unfair, and it doesn't mean that it's your fault. Some practical advice that I would whisper to new members of the nonprofit sector is to say no early and often. A healthy no keeps the yeses meaningful. Find mentors outside of your organization. They will remind you that there is a world beyond the four walls of your office. Don't confuse martyrdom with effectiveness. Being burnt out does not make you a stronger worker. The thing to carry with you and to always remember is that they will be okay without you. When it's time to move on, do it. Sometimes stepping away is the most sustainable thing that you can do for yourself and for the mission. At the end of the day, this is still just an employer. They owe you fair pay and a safe environment. Loving the mission does not erase that responsibility. This week, I want you to ask yourselves, what is the one thing that no one told you about this work that you wish that you had known? And what would you tell somebody just starting out? Your experiences matter, and they can guide others in their journey. And sharing these truths help to break the cycle. The next generation of nonprofit workers deserves not to fall into the same pitfalls that we have found ourselves. Thank you so much for listening. To everyone who shared their thoughts and experiences with me, thank you so much, and thank you for telling us the things that no one else would. Next week, we are cracking open the real job description, the one that they don't print, where other duties as assigned is code for all of those responsibilities that definitely weren't in the job posting. If this episode resonated and you feel that these conversations need to happen, help us reach more people. Share this episode, rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts, and subscribe to Burnout and Breakthroughs, because the more of us who stop suffering in silence, the stronger this movement becomes. Until then, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and I'll see you next week.